Hi, Brian Lehrer here. Up next, Brian Lehrer Weekend, three of our favorite segments from the week packaged together for you to listen to on the weekend. So enjoy, and I'll see you back on the radio Monday at 10 a.m. on WNYC and WNYC.org. Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. So what do government employees and people who work in television and the movies have in common? Answer, both sectors are gaining jobs in the New York City area right now. But how are those government employees and TV and film workers different from other people around here? They're more likely to be employed at all. The news organization The City notes that while the U.S. as a whole has regained 90% of the jobs lost during the pandemic, New York City has recovered fewer than half the jobs lost here. That's around 470,000 fewer people employed. Or as business and economics reporter Greg David writes, New York City's recovery crashed into a pothole in July with a decline in jobs for the first time this year. Amid more displays of the disproportionate impact of the pandemic recession on Black and Latino workers. One piece of more bullish economic news, Google's $2 billion real estate buy in Lower Manhattan this week is the latest indication that the tech sector still sees New York as a growth market. According to the New York Times, Google plans to add around 2,000 more jobs in the city. Other major tech companies are also projecting job growth. One more thing to set this up before Greg David joins us. There's a political story about the New York City economy right now, not just a dollars and cents one. The likely next mayor, Eric Adams, took a swipe at the outgoing mayor, Bill de Blasio, at a business conference last Friday when he told the audience this.
This is going to be a place where we welcome business and not turn into the dysfunctional city that we have been for so many years.
But are we that dysfunctional? And is the difference just talk? With me now is Greg David, business and economics contributor to the nonprofit news organization The City and director of the Business and Economics Reporting Program at the CUNY Graduate School of Journalism. Hi, Greg. Thanks for joining us. Welcome back to WNYC.
Good morning. Thanks for having me, and I'm very happy to be back.
And we'll get to Eric Adams and hear another clip from that speech where he dings de Blasio. But let's start with the first words in your recent article. New York City's recovery from the pandemic recession came to a screeching halt over the summer. What sectors were most affected?
Well, the sectors that are most affected, of course, are leisure and hospitality. That's where we've suffered the most. But in fact, virtually all sectors stopped adding jobs over the summer, with the exception of the two you named, government and movie and TV production. And that's as you gave all the numbers, it's really a bad story because New York was hit harder in the pandemic recession than virtually anywhere else. We have either the worst or the second worst recovery of any major city in the country. Our unemployment rate remains almost double the national average. And the summer was supposed to be when we were laying the groundwork for a major gain in the fall. But as everybody knows, the office workers did not come back after Labor Day in any significant numbers, and it's unclear if they're going to be back in significant numbers before the end of the year.
Why would jobs have been lost, though, rather than just come back more slowly as the Delta variant made people wary? And those office workers, they're working from home, so they're still employed, but there are still many more things open than there were 6 months ago, aren't there? So why would jobs have been lost this summer rather than just be coming back more slowly?
Well, I think that there was actually, it's not a huge number of job losses, but I think there's been some turmoil in the leisure and hospitality sector and restaurants. Restaurants, of course, are complaining bitterly that they have major staffing shortages. It's really a good question as to why we actually saw a decline, but we did. And it was you know, there's a little leakage in finance, there's a little leakage in business services, and it's pretty worrisome because we have so far to go.
Your article about the July numbers in particular said New York City loses jobs. This is the headline. New York City loses jobs as the pandemic recession takes growing toll on workers of color. So can you talk more specifically about the disparate impact?
Well, the disparate impact is that the unemployment rates for Black and Hispanic workers are very high, much higher. I think they're significantly higher than for white workers. And that's just the nature of this downturn. It's so unusual, you know, when you have a recession, it usually cuts across all sectors and all types of people. White collar workers lose their jobs, executives lose their jobs, lawyers lose their jobs, as well as people who work in retail or work in hotels or work in restaurants. But this recession is so different, so unequal, that office workers have kept their jobs. Wall Street's doing spectacularly. Pay and is up on Wall Street. But the people who were hurt the most, who tended to be heavily Black and Hispanic workers, worked in restaurants. They worked in hotels. They worked in what James Parrott, the economist, calls face-to-face jobs. And those are the jobs that disappeared and have not come back.
And some of the numbers there from your article, the unemployment rate for Black New Yorkers is 4 percentage points higher than for whites, and Latinos have a 7-point higher unemployment rate compared to whites, and that even college degrees don't narrow that gap. Why do you think that part's true?
Well, you know, that's a very interesting thing that I didn't know about until a month ago. Do you know that something like 40% of Black college graduates work in low-wage professions? And I found that to be a startling fact when I wrote about it a couple months ago. So I think that's part of the issue here. Also, of course, recent college graduates have had a hard time getting going in this recession.
So there's pandemic disparate impact multiplied by underlying structural inequality that preceded COVID.
Absolutely.
Listeners, help us report the story of jobs in and around New York City. Even as most of the talk is about recovery, did you get laid off from a job this summer? 646-435-7280. Curious to know what industry that was in. If you got laid off recently, 646-435-7280. Employers, we did a call-in for you recently about job openings you can't fill. Remember that? How about jobs you have recently had to eliminate? Or on the upside, recently created. You can talk about that, too. We're trying to report the full picture. So workers and employers, where are you seeing economic growth in our area? And where are you seeing layoffs? 646-435-7280, 646-435-7280, or tweet at Brian Lehrer. We'll watch our Twitter feed go by with Greg David, business and economics contributor to the nonprofit news organization The City and director of the Business and Economics Reporting Program at the Craig Newmark CUNY Graduate School of Journalism, 646-435-7280. Greg, you also compare New York City to the nation. So, for example, in July, New York City lost 14,000 jobs, while the rest of the country saw its strongest employment growth in a year. Can you compare and contrast?
Yes. Well, the country's adding jobs in lots of different ways. Restaurants are back in many parts of the country. Tourists are traveling to places like Florida, and therefore those states are recovering. You know, the whole point, the whole problem in New York is that our economy became very dependent on tourism. It was the great success story, of the last decade. We built this tourist industry that employed about 300,000 people, offered many good jobs and other pretty good jobs, mostly to people without college degrees. But our tourism industry was, of course, decimated by the pandemic. And because we get a significant number of our tourists from abroad, it hasn't bounced back. And that's why we are lagging the rest of the country. And then there's the great office worker problem. This economy is built on having 400 million square feet of office space occupied, driving the economies of the central business districts, especially in Manhattan. And at the moment, we think somewhere in the neighborhood of 30, maybe at the most 40% of those workers are back. So the restaurants may be open, but they don't have the lunch business that they would. And all the people who are based, whether they're in the Dunkin' Donuts that I like to go to in the morning or the places I want to go get lunch, just don't have the business that they used to have.
And with that Dunkin' Donuts product placement in the rearview mirror, just kidding. Vicki in Tudor City, you're on WNYC with Greg David. Hi, Vicki.
Oh, good morning. I just want to make the comment that there's loss from the top of the economic sector, too, because there was a major exodus, at least from Manhattan and probably from other boroughs, for people who have second homes. And from my limited knowledge of the Hamptons, they're staying there. And they have ancillary workers working for them, you know, dog walkers, housekeepers, childcare, drivers, things like that. And then also a certain sector and within that sector are people who work in offices and employ other people, and they're not showing up back either, so...
Vicki, and good points. Hello? And Greg, I'm sure you would agree.
Yes, there was a significant exodus. We actually do think many of those people have come back, especially as schools reopened, especially this year. They've come back because their kids are in school. And you can see that in other numbers, too. You know, apartment rents have started to rise again. Leasing activity is very strong. Condo sales have picked up again. So, yes, it was a very significant problem. Some of them are staying, but a lot of them have come back.
Is it an indicator of how many are staying away that also from your article within New York State, you note that the rest of the state is outperforming the city in jobs, I guess that's in new jobs, the opposite of before the pandemic. So how would you compare and contrast there?
Well, it's just that, you know, tourism and office workers aren't such a major factor outside the city. And one thing number I used is the sales tax increases. Sales tax has increased outside the city by at least double digits everywhere in the state, but only by about 7% in the city. Just another sign of how our economy is not recovering. The suburbs are doing much better, of course. And in part, we've discussed this on the show in the past. Some people say, well, it'll be fine because everybody's working at home and we're just transferring the economic activity from the business districts to the neighborhoods. But 30% of the New York City workforce is commuters, and those people are spending the money outside the city. So that's where we're really having, I think, a significant loss.
Yeah, and we recently had the mayor of, I'm trying to remember which town it was exactly, I think Middletown, New Jersey, who noted that local businesses there, in many cases, are doing better than before the pandemic, for exactly that reason. It's a commuter town and people are staying home who are employed. Robert in Newark, you're on WNYC. Hi, Robert.
Hi, thank you for having me on. One of the consequences that we've seen, I work for an office services company, with offices being closed and no office workers in there, all the equipment that is used, copiers, postage machines, coffee makers, and so forth. All of these pieces of equipment have gone idle, and the people who depend on them for a living, that say a copier company charges per copy for supplies and so forth, you know, the revenue is not realized from that anymore, and the people who service this equipment no longer have something to service because everybody's working from home and they're not in the offices. So it's another layer of this that affects us.
Thank you very much. Yeah, an interesting corner of the economy that we don't talk about very much, right? Kind of machine service industry.
You know, it's just that the lack of office workers is just rippling throughout the business districts and the economy. And the question is where we're going to go from here. You know, how many people are going to come back? Is remote work permanent, et cetera? So Cushman & Wakefield has estimated that the demand for New York City office space will permanently decline by 9%. Now, they told me that that won't be so bad. But when I talk to major landlords of major office buildings, they say 9% is a really big deal. And it's going to affect tax revenue. It's going to affect the value of the buildings. So I don't have any answers here because I don't know where we're going to be about remote work a year from now or when, or maybe I should say if, the COVID pandemic is over. But I do know that if we don't get the office space filled, we will not be in good shape in New York.
Well, maybe this is where we should bring in the Google real estate buy story. And then also we'll get in a few minutes to the political connection to the economy with another clip of Eric Adams seeming to rap de Blasio without saying his name. But Google and its big real estate move along the Hudson River near Houston Street. The New York Times frames its story as, while Manhattan has record office space vacancy levels during the pandemic, the four firms that make up so-called big tech, Amazon, Apple, Google, and Facebook, have staked a bullish position on the future of New York, even while most of them are planning for a more work-from-home future. How would you frame it?
Well, that's absolutely true, but the Google story is the most overhyped story of recent months. And that's because Google had already leased all the space in the building. The only difference here is instead of paying rent, Google decided to buy the building. They were always going to increase their headcount. They were always going to go to 12,000 people. There's no addition here. There is no addition here.
Though there is a long-term commitment implied, right?
Yes, but the lease was probably for 10 years, too. I don't know. Uh-huh. The point is right. Tech is an enormous part of New York City's future. The big tech companies are staying. We have enormous number of startups. Billions of dollars in venture capital is flowing into the city. Tech is really important to us. And it's a good sign. What would really have been a disaster is if Google had walked away from it. The things I'm watching are JPMorgan Chase's decision to go ahead and build its new headquarters on Park Avenue. If they were to change course, it would be a devastating blow to the economy. They are continuing. Actually, Jamie Dimon says different things at different times, but I think he wants everyone back in the office. And then there are two major office towers going up. SL Green is spending almost $3 billion to put a new office tower in Flatiron called One Madison. And a group, RXR and TF Cornerstone and Hyatt, are tearing down Donald Trump's once famous Grand Hyatt to build a mixed-use facility that will have a hotel, but will mostly be office space. And both projects, as far as I know, are committed to going ahead. And that's really what we need to watch. And that shows that those people are willing to put billions of dollars on the line with speculative building, that they have confidence in the New York City economy.
Yusuf in Newark, you're on WNYC. Hi, Yusuf. Thanks for calling in.
Hi, Brian. Thank you so much for taking my call. I just want to share. I just want to weigh in the disproportion between black and white in terms of the job loss. I just want to add one more component, which is probably the age. So I'm a civil engineer, right? I work with I was working in the minority-owned company, but in my civil department, it was seven of us, so I was the only black. But when it comes to laying off, because most of my projects were New York City projects, so New York City shut down. There was no work, so they have to lay off. So in my department, I would say fairly, I was, number four guy in terms of the hierarchy, right? But when it comes to laying off, I got laid off. And the other person that was laid off was Indian, but he was an older guy, even though he was with the company for a very long time, but he got laid off. So I just want to add the age component in this one here, even though there's race there, that the age component I can add to that, the loss of job during the pandemic.
Yeah. Greg, what are you thinking, listening to Yusuf? I think this probably, despite age discrimination laws, probably goes on across economic sectors. When a company needs to downsize, if they can lay off their older, therefore presumably higher paid workers, they're going to take that opportunity.
That's true, and that does happen, but the statistics say exactly the opposite. The most damage has been done to young people. Young people have the highest unemployment rates. Young people are not finding jobs. Young people are dropping out of the labor force. This recession's working very differently. I think a lot of that would happen in white-collar jobs and professional jobs. And, of course, there have been so few cutbacks there.
Yusuf, thank you very much. Another one about age, though, I think. Betty in Nassau County, you're on WNYC. Hi, Betty.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I'm calling because it just seems to be that it's the same issue that the gentleman before me mentioned. My husband, after working at the same job for 27 years, being their superstar, them saying you'll never get laid off, the pandemic happened, and he was one of the first to be laid off. He's 62 years old, and several people were called back, younger people without his seniority. He's one of the most senior people working at his job. He's working as a skilled model maker, which is someone that does prototype engineering designs for a prestigious company.
Betty, thank you very much. Going to go right on to another caller. Nikki in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Nikki.
Hey, Brian. Great to be on your show again. So I'm in healthcare, and I'm an X-ray and mammography tech. And what I'm seeing is that we've lost a lot of people, whether it's either they died from COVID, they left the city, or they're retired. So there are a lot of openings in healthcare. And what's been going on with my situation is that I've been getting a lot of calls from headhunters who see my resume on Indeed. And I've been fielding these calls. And it's been really exhilarating because now we're in the driver's seat when it comes to which job we accept and which jobs we turn down.
Are the wage offers going up with the shortage?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Absolutely.
Nikki, thank you very much. Interesting call, Greg, from an X-ray technician.
Yes, and we definitely know that many people are in the driver's seat, that many jobs are hard to fill. And, you know, she mentioned something that's very important. A lot of people have decided to retire. There's a tremendous movement of people in their late 60s, mid-60s, or even a little younger than that, to say, you know, working isn't what it's cracked up to be. I do have enough money. I'm going to retire early. So we have seen a significant decline in those workers remaining on the job.
We're going to take a brief pause here, and when we come back, we're going to play another clip of Eric Adams speaking at a business conference last week, saying things are going to be better for businesses, assuming he's elected mayor, kind of a back of the hand to Bill de Blasio. But I'm going to ask our guest, business and economics journalist Greg David, whether he's really saying anything that's so different from what de Blasio does. And listeners, we can add phone calls on this too. In particular, anybody, let's say business owner, looking for the next mayor, presumably Eric Adams, to change things in a particular way, 646-435-7280. We'll continue after this. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with Greg David, business and economics contributor to the nonprofit news organization The City and director of the Business and Economics Reporting Program at the Craig Newmark CUNY Graduate School of Journalism. We're talking primarily about Greg's recent article on New York City losing jobs this summer, even as the rest of the country gained jobs. And before we get to that Eric Adams clip and the politics of some of this, we were asking for people to call in and talk about what sectors of the economy you may have just gotten laid off from. And let me take a few more of those that just came in just to help us report this story. Mary Ellen in Washington Township, you're on WNYC. Hi, Mary Ellen.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Hi, Brian. I'm in the trade show industry, and back in March 20th, they pretty much shut down our company. It's approximately like 50 people. So is anywhere from designers who design graphics or booths to trade show coordinators to people in the warehouse who do shipping, receiving, and pack up the booths for trade shows. Our industry, I felt, really got hit hard and also affects so many other industries like the hospitality industry and whatnot. So it's just trying to see, like, we haven't been called back. We actually got officially laid, like, you know, our jobs ended in September of 2020. But I'm hearing a few of my coworkers are picking up. The sales guys were working from home. But I just was wondering, anybody seeing any movement on that industry?
Yeah, it's a good one to point up. I know we reported the story when, I think it was the auto show. Greg, do you know if I'm remembering the right thing? The auto show in New York that was supposed to take place around now, but because of the Delta variant, you know, and it was going to be the big return of the auto show, but with the Delta variant, they canceled it. I have a friend who was supposed to fly in from San Francisco for a round number high school reunion. That got canceled. So it's not a trade show, but it's another thing that affects event spaces like trade shows would be in. So that's an interesting indicator, too.
Yes, the Delta variant and the rise in cases clearly has been this huge roadblock. We thought we were going to be starting to do in-person events. We thought business travel was going to pick up some, and that didn't happen. You know, it's the story that we're all facing. We need to get everyone vaccinated to see these cases decline. I will say that I did look at the numbers, and both nationally and in New York, there is some signs that this wave is ebbing. They're early signs, but let us hope that it does ebb, because you're right. Trade shows, business travel, and a pickup in tourism are the things we need.
And Fanny in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Fanny. Thanks for calling in.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call, Brian. I'm a restaurant worker, and I've been laid off since March 2020. And I work in a private club in Manhattan, and a lot of our members are from all over the world, and a lot of them either cannot come into New York or they've moved to their second home. So our business has declined considerably. And I really don't know when I will be going back to work. They have opened up, but they really aren't busy enough to have me come back yet, although I do have almost 20 years of working there. I recently went for a couple of job interviews, and I would have taken them, but the contribution to healthcare was so expensive that I had to decline. And had we had universal healthcare, I probably would have taken a position. But right now, I'm still unemployed.
Fandy, thank you for your call, and good luck to you. So I guess that's a wrinkle of the hospitality industry, Greg, private clubs.
Yes, but I would say that all the restaurateurs who are listening to this are going ballistic at the moment because there are so many restaurant jobs that are going begging. And restaurants say that their biggest problem is they can't get enough staff to increase their business. I think the story is a little more complicated than that, but there is no doubt that there are an enormous number of restaurant jobs available.
But if you take Fanny's story at face value, the restaurant jobs are available to her, but the wages aren't enough to make up for the high dollar amount that she would have to pay contributing to her health insurance. And so the wages would have to go up with this shortage of workers in the hospitality industry. And yet, maybe the margins are too small.
They are raising wages, though. Every restaurateur I've talked to has raised wages. Now, for the people who work on tips, it's a little more complicated because maybe there aren't as many patrons there every day that there used to be, et cetera. I would wonder whether she works in one of the few places that is unionized, and that makes a very big difference for her. You know, the hotel workers who are, for the most part, unionized by one of the city's most and belong to one of the city's most powerful unions, haven't gone out to find other jobs because they believe that they will get their jobs back. And when hotels do reopen, all their workers come back. They have no trouble hiring. So that's a little sidelight.
That's really interesting. The difference between hotel workers and restaurant workers, even though we think of them as being related in the hospitality industry. And this has to do with unionization, you're saying?
Absolutely. The Hotel Trades Council has unionized the vast majority of hotels. And when the de Blasio administration finishes work on their promise, we won't build another hotel in New York that's not unionized because every hotel is going to need city council approval. And if you look at the wages, there's a good James Parrott at the New School just put out a really good report on the hospitality industry. The average wage in a hotel in Manhattan is something north of $55,000 a year. So those are pretty good salaries. They're just about, they're a little bit above the median for the city. So that's what's going on there.
And you also noted in one of your articles that while the pandemic recession has been harder on women than men overall, public sector unions largely prevented that gender gap from taking root there. So what are some specifics about that?
Well, New York has one of the most unionized public sector in the country. The unions are very strong. Only 3% of unionized women in the public sector in New York City lost their jobs in the pandemic. Most of those, the majority of those people work in education. The UFT did a lot to make sure their members stayed employed. And of course, they were a major partner in getting the schools open last spring, keeping them open today. Very important little sidelight on what's happened.
And here's Roz, a chef in the East Village, who wants to back up our last caller, Fanny. He says, hi, Roz, you're on WNYC.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for taking my call. This is the second time in a couple of weeks on the same issue. But yeah, I work at a club in Midtown, and they're really dragging their feet reopening. Maybe one day a week we get to work as union employees, or maybe 3 days a week if we're lucky. And I think this is a call out to Governor Hochul that not everyone should be available for unemployment again, but a few people in our industry in particular.
Thank you, Roz. I hear you. All right, politics, as he brings up Governor Hochul in our last few minutes. Eric Adams said in his speech to a business group last week that if elected mayor, he will welcome business in contrast to the dysfunctional city it has been for many years. It's the way he described it. And then he said this.
Government must do its job to create an environment for growth that includes lower crime. We have to curb COVID, fewer homeless, as you see on our streets, greater affordability and partnership with the business community.
So, Greg, is that just rhetoric from a candidate, or is he proposing specific different policies from Bill de Blasio that the business community is waiting for?
Well, I can't answer that question because I've been asking for an interview with him for weeks so that I could put those questions to him, and they don't seem interested in having me talk to him. So I guess I will say I don't know, but this is what I do know. The business community in large measure saw Bill de Blasio as hostile, that he didn't care about them, that he wouldn't listen, that he shoved their concerns to the side. When after Adams gave that speech and I talked to people in the business community whose views I track, all of them said that this was good news. They were really looking forward to Adams, and they believe him on this. And, you know, he does have a track record. He has been a fairly pro-development borough president. And like the things he said, business leaders say the same things to me. Their workers are afraid of the rise of crime. Their workers are afraid of the subway. Their workers are unhappy coming to work and navigating their way to the offices through the increase in the number of homeless. So he has struck a nerve. There are a lot of people waiting with bated breath for him to win in November and become the next mayor. But whether he has substantive policies, I can't answer that.
Well, and, you know, de Blasio has a reputation among many progressives of talking like a socialist, but then giving real estate developers so much leeway to build market rate housing and forcing city employees back to their office jobs at the request of the office building landlords and other things like that. Same thing on crime, which Adams referenced in that clip. Progressives say de Blasio came in as a reformer, but is basically doing the things that Adams suggested in his campaign, or suggests in his campaign, that he would do, to the activists' chagrin. So TBD if there's a there or a difference there.
That's a good point. But people are forgetting the first term of Bill de Blasio, where lots of things did take place. He was a key player in getting the minimum wage to $15, true, paid sick leave, universal pre-K for four-year-olds. He did a lot of progressive things in his first term. And as for the rest, his affordable housing program has been very ambitious. I'm in the camp of many people who believe you can't have a strong economy without growth. It's very expensive to build in New York. I just wrote about the rezoning that's coming in Gowanus. If we don't build in Gowanus, we will have there won't be enough money to clean up the Superfund toxic site in the neighborhood. If we want to diversify our economy and have less residential segregation in New York, we're going to have to build in places like Gowanus, which is becoming increasingly white and wealthy.
Greg David, business and economics contributor to the nonprofit news organization The City and director of the Business and Economics Reporting Program at the Craig Newmark CUNY Graduate School of Journalism. Greg, thanks so much.
Thank you, Brian.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. With all the vaccine booster news right now, I'm very glad to have Dr. Paul Offit with us. He's a member of the FDA's Vaccines and Related Biological Products Advisory Committee. You know about the FDA advisors voting to recommend for now that third doses be allowed only for people over 65 or with certain underlying conditions or for healthcare workers or others whose jobs put them at risk for COVID exposure. You know this is only for those who got the Pfizer vaccine for now. Maybe you heard today's news that Johnson & Johnson released a study showing an additional shot of its vaccine substantially boosts its effectiveness. Dr. Offit recently said he thought the timing of all this was being rushed to meet an artificial timeline set by the president, of course, a number of other countries are already giving boosters. And then there's the approval being considered for first dose vaccines for children as young as 5. Dr. Offit also has a new book that he started writing before the pandemic, but that kind of puts a lot of this into a fascinating historical context. It's called You Bet Your Life, From Blood Transfusions to Mass Vaccination, The Long and Risky History of Medical Innovation. So we'll talk about the news, we'll talk about the book, we'll talk about where they fit together. In his day job, Dr. Paul Offit is director of the Vaccine Education Center at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. Dr. Offit, so good to have you today. Thanks for coming on WNYC.
Thank you, Brian. It's my pleasure.
First, to be clear, are you on the same FDA Vaccine Advisory Committee that made the formal recommendation on Friday?
Yes, I am.
And I saw you said on CNN that you think this is being rushed to fit President Biden's artificial timeline after he said this summer that boosters would be available starting September 20th, which was yesterday. Do you think the science isn't there for any of this yet?
Well, no, I wouldn't say that. I think by setting a September 20th deadline and saying this is going to happen on September the 20th, you're going to get a third dose. It'll be available for the general population. It'll be 8 months after the first dose. I don't think he necessarily got ahead of the science as much as he got ahead of the scientific process. I mean, there is a process here. In theory, you have a problem, the problem being waning immunity. You have a solution, which is a booster dose. You have data that show that that's a solution. Then you submit those data to the Food and Drug Administration, which is a regulatory body, and then allows you to distribute then the vaccine under certain guidelines. And then it goes to the CDC, which is a recommending body. And we're still waiting for that recommendation, hopefully have it by the end of the week, in terms of who exactly would most benefit from a booster dose. So they sort of sideline the FDA, sideline the CDC, which I think is never a good idea.
A number of countries in Europe, plus Israel and the Middle East, are well into vaccine booster distribution. Are you saying that's too political over there and not science-based enough?
Well, you know, it's what's the goal of the vaccine? The goal of the vaccines, as stated by Dr. Rochelle Walensky and others, is to prevent serious illness. The immunological mechanism of preventing serious illness is something called immunological memory cells, memory B cells, memory T cells. A number of investigators, John Wary at Penn, Shane Crotty at La Jolla, and others, have found that, not surprisingly, memory cells are long-lived. And all the data generated in the United States suggests that's true, because if you look, at least in this country, at the capacity of those of two doses of mRNA-containing vaccine to prevent serious illness, you find that it remains high. It remains high against Delta. It remains high for all age groups. So the data that we're seeing here do not really reflect what's being seen in Israel. So do you really want to use an Israeli experience to determine how you're going to practice medicine in the United States? So at least regarding prevention of serious illness, the vaccine seems to be holding up. What has eroded is what you would expect to erode at some level, which is neutralizing antibodies start to decline after two doses of mRNA vaccine. With that, you get a greater risk of asymptomatic infection, mildly symptomatic infection, even low moderately symptomatic infection associated with increased contagiousness. So there you can argue that to give a booster dose will, in theory, decrease to some extent the contagiousness of this virus and therefore the spread of this virus. So that's really the question. To what extent a booster dose for the over 65 or a booster dose for people who are at high risk is going to change the arc of this pandemic as compared to what everybody agrees is going to change the arc of this pandemic, which is vaccinating people who are unvaccinated. I mean, at our hospital, when we see people come into the IC, into the intensive care unit, it's not because they didn't get their third dose. It's because they've never gotten any dose. And so that's really an issue.
So do you see a zero-sum game issue of boosters for the United States preventing initial shots around the world, therefore slowing the defeat of the pandemic overall?
Well, that would be sad. I mean, I hope that's not the way it works out. Certainly, we have pledged or given about 100 million doses so far. But you can argue that all the doses that we're being given now in this we are about to give or have given as a third dose would be better served in another country, because certainly it's a worldwide pandemic. We know that these variants are being created in other countries. I mean, Delta at least was first detected in India, the Alpha variant first detected in the United Kingdom. So what happens in this world does affect us. So it's not an altruistic act to give vaccines to the developing happening. World, the WHO has been somewhat critical about giving third doses in this situation. I mean, Dr. Fauci and the public health advisors to the administration believe that by giving a third dose that we can change the arc of this pandemic. We'll see. I hope they're right. I hope that's true. But I think we all would agree that if we really want to change the arc of this pandemic, it's about taking that roughly 60 to 65 million people in this country who are simply refusing to get a vaccine and vaccinate them.
Yeah. You and others have said the science supports boosters for people 60 and over. The official recommendation that came down from your committee last Friday starts with age 65. What happened to those five additional years?
Right. So I think where that came from was that in Israel, that's their observation, that there started to be a waning of protection against serious disease in those greater than 60. And that's not what we're seeing in the U.S. In the U.S., it's still, even in people over 65, there appears to be protection. So I'm not sure there's a critical difference there. In my mind, recommending a third dose for people over 65, frankly, is the same thing as recommending a third dose for those who are immune compromised, which we've already done, because as you get older and you're over 65, your immune system is more senescent, and so it's your capacity to make a robust immune response isn't as good. So that's really how I put it, the greater than 65-year-old, someone in the immune compromised category.
New this morning, Johnson & Johnson's just released data showing very strong protection with a second shot. Of course, that's been a one-shot vaccination. How long should J&J recipients have to wait, especially given the slightly lower protection that the J&J seemed to give to begin with, for approval for them?
Right. So it's interesting. When we, the FDA's Vaccine Advisory Committee, met at the end of February to discuss the J&J vaccine, you could see that they had done some two-dose vaccine work. They'd done it preclinically in non-human primates, and you clearly saw there was a 2.5 to 3-fold increase in neutralizing antibody titers. And that was also true in their so-called phase one trials in people. So it was not surprising then that a second dose would, associated with that increase in neutralizing antibodies, now apparently has been associated with increased effectiveness. J&J sold themselves as a one-dose vaccine, and that was the advantage. It looks like there's an additional advantage to the second dose. But again, those data have to be submitted to the FDA, reviewed by the FDA, then go to the CDC. So I think we're still talking about at least a few weeks till we get a clear evidence or a clear recommendation from the CDC on the second dose for J&J's vaccine.
By the way, did you see Cedric the Entertainer on the Emmys Sunday night say the Pfizer is like the Neiman Marcus of vaccines, Moderna is the Macy's, and Johnson & Johnson, that's TJ Maxx? I know it's comedy, but was he being fair to J&J?
I don't think so. I think if you look at the capacity of one dose of J&J's vaccine to induce memory cells, it's excellent. So the capacity of J&J to protect against serious disease is also excellent. So, and it was an advantage as a single dose. I think now we're starting to focus on something that's going to be a lot harder to get in control, which is this notion of trying to prevent shedding, meaning asymptomatic shedding or mildly symptomatic shedding. That is a high bar for a vaccine. I think if I could go back and do this all over again, the one thing I would love to see not happen is to use the term breakthrough illness to describe an asymptomatic infection or a mildly symptomatic infection. That's just not fair. I mean, that holds this vaccine to way too high of a standard. Most of the vaccines we have out there, whooping cough vaccine, influenza vaccine, rotavirus vaccine, the job of those vaccines is to prevent severe illness, to prevent hospitalization, ICU admission, death, and those vaccines do that. But they certainly aren't very good about preventing asymptomatic infection or mildly symptomatic infection, and it would be unfair to call those infections breakthrough infections with those illnesses.
Dr. Paul Offit with us from the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia and the FDA Vaccine Advisory Committee that approved the booster dose for the populations we've been discussing on Friday. Your book is called You Bet Your Life, From Blood Transfusions to Mass Vaccination, The Long and Risky History of Medical Innovation. Why do you focus on the intersection between innovation and risk?
Because it's always there. I mean, we learn as we go. There's a learning curve, and there is invariably a human price for knowledge. That's true here with this vaccine. I think, you know, with the mRNA vaccines, there was never any indication, either in preclinical studies and experimental animals, or in the phase one or two or three studies, even involving tens of thousands of people, that myocarditis would have ever been a problem. But it is a problem, primarily in, you know, the 16 to 17-year-old male who gets this vaccine, or that the J&J or AstraZeneca vaccines would be associated with a severe clotting problem, including something called cerebral venous sinus thrombosis, which is basically a blood clot in your brain. I think you learn as you go. And I do think we're intolerant of that. We'd like to believe we know everything at a particular point in time, but we don't. So the question is never when do you know everything, it's when do you know enough. This came up for me, actually, just being on the FDA Vaccine Advisory Committee, with regard to the 12 to 15-year-old vaccine recommendation. So that was a 2,300-child study. Half were given vaccine, half were given placebo. There were 18 cases of COVID in those children 12 to 15 years of age, all in the placebo group. And so that vaccine then was permitted under emergency use authorization to be given to the 12 to 15-year-old. I got a lot of angry emails from people saying, 2,300 children? That's all you want to study? Don't you want to study more than that? Why not study 23,000, making it a little closer to what we did for the adults? So you could do a 23,000-child study, and then presumably there wouldn't have been 18 cases of COVID in the placebo group. There may have been 180 cases. So when do you pull the trigger? When do you cross the line? And that's what I do in this book, is go through, you know, 9 major medical advances that have caused us to live 30 years longer now than we did 100 years ago, and to sort of stop at various points in time and say, all right, would you get it now? Would you get it now? And you can see that, and then the story continues, and you can see basically it's one tragedy after another as we move forward. We learn as we go, and it's that knowledge that is invariably hard-earned.
And one of your chapters is about the initial rollout of the polio vaccine, which you also wrote a whole separate book about, I know, a few years ago. And that rollout was controversial. Now we accept the polio vaccine unquestioningly. So what happened then, and does it relate to now?
Right. There were two things that were interesting there. One is that Jonas Salk made his polio vaccine by taking polio virus, growing it up in cell culture, purifying the virus, and then inactivating the virus with a chemical. That's the way he made it. 5 companies stepped forward to make that vaccine, to mass produce it and distribute it. One of them made it badly. Cutter Laboratories of Berkeley, California, failed to fully inactivate the virus. As a consequence, 120,000 children were inoculated with live, fully virulent polio virus. 40,000 developed abortive or short-lived polio, meaning temporary paralysis. 164 were permanently paralyzed, and 10 were killed. I think it's probably one of the worst biological disasters in this country's history. But it didn't slow, and so we learned from it. We learned about how to mass produce that vaccine. And that was a remarkable tragedy. There was another tragedy there that was kind of hidden that I think people didn't pay attention to, and it's this. The trial that was done, the study that was done to test Jonas Salk's vaccine, broke his heart. It's not what he wanted to do. He had made his vaccine. He tested it in 700 children in the Pittsburgh area. He said, "Eureka, I've got it. The vaccine's safe and it works." But the March of Dimes and the federal government wanted to do a big study to prove that it worked. So they gave the vaccine to 420,000 children. These are first and second graders in the 1950s. I was a first and second grader in the 1950s. And they gave 200,000 placebo doses to children in the first and second grade. He could not conscience giving salt water to children as we entered the summer during a polio epidemic. Mm-hmm. And so what ended up happening was the vaccine was declared safe, potent, and effective. But how did we know it was effective? We knew it was effective because 16 children died in that study, all in the placebo group of polio. We knew it was effective because 36 children were paralyzed permanently in that study, 34 in the placebo group. But for the flip of a coin, those children would be my age now and could have lived a long, healthy and productive life. But again, you learn as you go, and again, always, what price knowledge?
And that's, yeah, why even with some risk, you approve at a certain point if you've got that other side of the data, like those that concentration of deaths in the placebo group. A non-vaccine example from your book was the introduction of blood transfusions. Can you tell us a little bit of that story, the dramatic innovation and the risks in that case?
Sure. So that, the way I tell that story is say, okay, would you get a blood transfusion now? So you start a couple hundred years ago when we basically were transfusing blood from farm animals into people. Would you get a vaccine? Would you get a, sorry, a blood transfusion then? Okay, so then you move to the early 1900s and we identify blood types, A types, you know, the A, B, O blood categories. Okay, would you get a vaccine? Would you get, sorry, a blood transfusion now? But we still hadn't identified yet the so-called Rh factor, right? So you're O positive, O negative. That positive or negative is the Rh factor. So, okay, then you know about the Rh factor. Would you get a blood transfusion now? And then what happens is human immunodeficiency virus, the AIDS virus, enters the blood supply and, you know, kills tens of thousands of people who got contaminated blood transfusions. Okay, would you get a blood transfusion now, knowing that there are many viruses for which we don't test the whole blood, knowing that there are viruses we don't yet know about, would you get it now? Okay, knowing that there are risks there, would you be one of the first to volunteer for artificial blood, which is currently being tested in the laboratory? You know, when do you feel you know enough to make the right decision? Another example would be, you know, heart transplants. There's 4,000 people currently waiting for a heart transplant in this country. 1,300 will die while waiting. Do you want to be one of the first people to get a pig heart as a transplant? So that's what this book is about. It's about when do you know enough to say, okay, I want to enter this medical innovation now.
Janet in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with Dr. Paul Offit. Hi, Janet.
Oh, hi. Thank you very much. First of all, I'm confused when we say that the two levels to this question. One is, when we say the FDA approved a vaccine or approved a drug, how many people are we talking about here? Who gets to vote on it? Like, is it the Supreme Court where they say, well, 5 are in favor and 4 are against, so it's approved? And the reason I'm asking is I heard a very disturbing story on NPR that 2 very high-profile members of the FDA, I guess voting members, so strongly disagreed with the decision made by the majority on the FDA that they publicly resigned. And they were being interviewed, or the reporter on this was being interviewed on NPR, and somebody said, oh, people come and go from the FDA all the time. And the other reporter said, but wait a minute, these were not just people. These were the highest profile specialists in vaccines. And they felt strongly enough about the decision that the FDA made. They disagreed with it strongly enough
regarding
that they
boosters.
Resigned publicly.
Janet, thank you. I'm sure you know those scientists, Dr. Offit. How would you tell that story?
So the story, here's the story. There are 18 voting members on the FDA Vaccine Advisory Committee. Those voting members are not affiliated with the FDA. They're not affiliated with any pharmaceutical companies. They are independent. We voted then ultimately to approve booster dosing in a limited manner. The two people that resigned, Marion Gruber and Phil Krause, worked for the FDA. They were senior officials at the FDA. They resigned before we ever had that vote. They resigned because they didn't like the process, as you alluded to earlier, Brian, you know, where basically a date was set. I think they felt that the FDA's arm was being twisted to approve the vaccine as a third dose for everybody who was going to be, you know, over 16 years of age. And they didn't like that. And basically this resignation was a protest for that. But it really had nothing to do with the booster vote, per se. This all happened before the booster vote. I think my guess is that they would approve of the way the booster vote played out, because we really rejected the Biden administration desire, and I think Pfizer's desire, to give this vaccine to the general population, to everybody over 16 as a booster dose. So I think they probably would have approved of that outcome.
So kind of a follow-up on that, and I know you have to go in a minute. The vaccine approval process for 5 to 11-year-olds, what would you need to see to decide that's safe for, you know, the developing bodies of that age group, and do you assess it differently from vaccines for adults? This plays into the risk versus benefit formula. That's the premise of your book, too.
Exactly. So you want to see, first of all, how they came to the conclusion that they were giving not 30 micrograms of messenger RNA, but 10 micrograms, so a third of the dose. That's 2 separate doses, again, 3 weeks apart. So look at the so-called phase 1 dose-ranging data to see how they came to that conclusion. 2, to look most importantly at safety. Look at every child to see whether or not there were any safety issues, and whether they had sort of the same problems with really the second dose associated with fever, headache, fatigue, joint ache, muscle ache. And three, see, look at the consistency of the responses to make sure that, that you know, it wasn't just it wasn't like 80% or 85% that were having good antibody responses, but it was closer to 100%. So you really need to see the data. Right now, again, we're in the sort of era of science by press release, so we're just looking at top line data provided by the company. We really need to look at the details. And with that, you know, then we'll do what we always do, which is that if we say yes, we would allow this vaccine to be distributed to 5 to 11-year-olds, what we're really saying is, would we give it to our own children or nieces or nephews or grandchildren? That's really the bar that we hold every vaccine to.
Well, that's right. What would you say to parents who may have rushed to get a vaccine for themselves, but say, my six-year-old, I don't know.
Well, that's what they always say. I mean, we see our children as more vulnerable. But I think, and this is sort of the theme of the book, too, is that there are no risk-free choices. There's just choices to take different risks. And I think your job is to, in the most clear-eyed, dispassionate way possible, choose the lesser risk.
Dr. Paul Offit's new book is You Bet Your Life, From Blood Transfusions to Mass Vaccination, The Long and Risky History of Medical Innovation. If you want to see him in a virtual town hall, it will be next Wednesday, September 29th, sponsored by the Seattle Town Hall. There's a $5 fee to attend virtually, except it's free if you're 22 years old or under. Again, Seattle Town Hall next Wednesday, September 29th, 9 p.m. Eastern Time, virtual event with Dr. Paul Offit. Thank you so much for joining us today. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. More to come. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Now a conversation about a bug that you're supposed to kill, and some creatures we're killing too many of. Have you noticed a new colorful bug in your backyard or in the parks that you visit? It's pretty, beige and black and white with spots and bright red wings that you can see when its wings are open. It's new to the neighborhood in our area. And if you spot this spotted lanternfly, that's its name, the spotted lanternfly, your instructions from the government are clear. Squish it. It's an invasive species, that's why, that hitchhiked with a shipment from Asia to Pennsylvania, and it's made it to New Jersey and Staten Island, and now to Central Park and Riverside Park in Manhattan. I'm told it even showed up in a 4-H exhibit at the Kansas State Fair. So why, when we're worried about the die-offs of, say, monarch butterflies and bees, are we being asked to step on this bug? For more on this invader and the insects we need, I'm joined by entomologist Jessica Ware, associate curator in invertebrate zoology at the American Museum of Natural History and vice president of the Entomological Society of America. Dr. Ware, thank you so much for joining us. Welcome to WNYC.
Thanks for having me.
An etymologist studies words, an entomologist studies insects, right?
That's right.
And I learned in college zoology that you're supposed to say zoology, not zoology. Is that right?
I do say zoology, so maybe I bucked the trend. I guess I'm a rebel.
Or maybe my professor was just, old-timey in that respect. So the New York City Parks Department website reminds us we aren't allowed to harm wildlife, but they're making an exception for this bug, the spotted lanternfly. It's not directly harmful to people or pets, though. Is that correct?
Yeah, they really are not going to harm you. They live their life outside of the human condition, but they are a potential economic threat for agriculture. And so we really want to try and prevent their spread. We want to contain them and prevent their spread. And so this is why we're really urging people to make observations, let people know where you're seeing this bug, and squish it.
And listeners, question for you. Have you spotted these spotted lantern flies? Did you rise to the challenge and step on it? Do you have a question for entomologist Jessica Ware about this bug or about how to help the bees or butterflies that there are now too few of? Tweet at Brian Lehrer or call us at 646-435-7280. 646-435-7280 for Jessica Ware. So why are we being deputized to go after this public enemy number one bug?
Well, I think that the main goal of what we are trying to do as entomologists is to prevent the spread of this really invasive bug. So this bug can feed on over 70 host plants, which is a pretty big range, and it really prefers the tree of heaven. And as you know, if you've ever driven on the turnpike, the tree of heaven is everywhere. It really loves to grow kind of in clumps, kind of along highways and disturbed areas. It was on the cover of A Tree Grows in Brooklyn, if you remember that that story. And Tree of Heaven is everywhere. So that's its main preferred host plant is everywhere, which means the potential damage that this bug could cause is actually pretty extreme. So with that in mind, we want to try and stop what we've had many invasive species arrive on the shores here. And not all of them have been stopped, and they've kind of spread across the entire United States. Our goal with spotted lanternfly is to prevent that from happening.
And there are pictures of the full-grown insects and their eggs on the New York City Parks website, and we'll link to that on our webpage so citizen exterminators know what to look for. But what's the best way to kill them if you're squeamish?
Well, I mean, the thing is that these are very good at jumping. They're actually in a group that's called the hoppers or tree hoppers or leaf hoppers. And so if you go towards them, they often will just kind of jump and start flying. So you can just step on them with your shoe is probably the easiest way. But really, you know, even if you feel very, very squeamish, making observations of where you're seeing adults, where you're seeing nymphs, which don't have the red, they look kind of like a beautiful a black with white polka dot little insect. Or if you see egg masses, which kind of look like old gum, kind of gray gum stuck to the bark or even the sides of buildings, any observations that you make are going to be helpful for people to understand where there's the bulk of the individuals. But stepping on them with your shoe is a good plan, is a good method.
Should we report spotting them?
Yes, you should. You might think, oh, there's so many of them. Entomologists don't need to know where there's a few more. That's not true. We need to know where they are. You can write to your local entomology department. You can write to your local university. There are extension websites that are out there on spotted lanternfly, all of which have contact information for you to report. If you see something, say something is kind of a slogan that we are familiar with here in New York. The same thing applies for the spotted lanternfly. If you see them, if you see signs of the nymphs, if you see the adults, if you see eggs, say something. Let people know where you're finding them.
Lisa in West New York, you're on WNYC. Hi, Lisa.
Hi. We have a lot of them. We're on Boulevard East and 60th Street in West New York. And when I first saw the story in the Bergen Record, and I posted it on our Facebook page, so a lot of people started reporting it. And I see them in the ground level. I'm on the 21st floor, but it's impossible. I mean, she just said, call your local entomology department. What's that? Where do I find that? You make it impossible to report it. And the article said all these different counties have the infestation, but so do we. And you know, how do we let the right person know about it?
Yeah, that's a good question. And sometimes it can be hard to know who to contact. For New Jersey, the New Jersey Department of Agriculture. For New York, the New York Department of Agriculture. Each of them have websites with links and phone numbers where you can call and just leave a voicemail. And then some of them have electronic forms where you can indicate when you've seen one. You could also contact Rutgers University. Rutgers University has an extension department with people that are dedicated, that are working specifically on spotted lanternfly. So does Penn State. So does Cornell University. So you have there's a few different options, a few different ways that you can get the information to the experts.
Lisa, I hope that's helpful. Okay, we're getting all kinds of calls. You know that our lines are completely full. Maybe that doesn't surprise you because the infestation is that big. But I'm going to take the most surprising one because people are calling about their backyards. It was surprising enough that caller saw one, you know, around a high-rise building. But Ingrid in Woodside is going to top them all, I think. Ingrid, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi. I was in the Flushing line yesterday afternoon and almost reaching Grand Central. And there was this, all of a sudden I noticed this fly on my arm. And I got up and the person close to me this is the Chinese fly. It is very bad. And she said, we need to kill it. She took her shoe off and killed it.
Well, bravo to your fellow subway rider. So it's not, it actually doesn't surprise me that you would have had one on you, because these insects are really good hitchhikers. And that's part of why we're really urging people to make observations and to keep their eyes open, because these bugs can basically hitch a ride on you. They hitched a ride on you on the train line. They can hitch a ride on your car. They can hitch a ride on your luggage. They can hitch a ride. We think that's how they got here. They hitched a ride on a shipment of something that came into the States. So because they're good at just kind of clinging to things and then being carried to new locations, that's what poses one of the biggest risks for the spread of this bug, is that they're just going to hitchhike to other parts of the United States, and that's the fear. It doesn't surprise me that it stayed clinging to you. Just like all insects, they have six legs, and their tarsi kind of have little claws that can kind of cling to fabric. So they can stay stuck to you, waiting, hopefully, to start flying as soon as you had gotten out of the subway station to their new spot.
So even on the 7 train.
Even on the 7 train. They can't eat on the 7 train, but they can take a ride and then get off on the next person to go to another location. They're very good dispersers, which is one of the things that make them an excellent invader.
Maybe we can get them for fair beating. Its name makes it sound very benign. Spotted lantern fly. But does it actually fly? I've seen it. You talked about it being a hopper. Does it actually fly?
Yeah, they do fly. And when they fly, that's when you see that kind of striking hindwing, which is bright red with black polka dots on it. I wouldn't say that they're not the type of butterfly flight that you might be familiar with, that kind of flapping style flight where they're hovering in the air for long periods of time. They don't fly in that way. It's really, they can fly for feet. They can fly for several meters. But it's not very high up in the air column. And when you see them, honestly, they are so beautiful. It really makes you feel sad to chase them with your shoe. But they definitely can fly.
Mandy in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Mandy.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm calling from Brooklyn. I live across the street from Prospect Park on the 8th floor of a building, and I'm killing probably 2 or 3 of these a day. It started several weeks ago that I noticed anyway. And one, I didn't hear you mention Prospect Park in Brooklyn, and I'm curious how prevalent they are being reported here and what else we can be doing. Is there something I can do in my garden to prevent them hatching again next spring? And what is happening in the park to protect the park?
I guess they transferred from the 7 train to the number 2 at Times Square and rode down to you. Professor Ware?
It wouldn't surprise me if they had done so. Well, I mean, certainly you can make some plans to reduce the available habitat and space that they're going to have for next year. One thing you can do is you can look, if you have your own property and there are any tree of heaven on your property, you can try and have that removed. Now, cutting tree of heaven isn't a great idea because it actually will just make more sprouted, more shoots come up. But there are professional people that can work to get rid of tree of heaven if you do have it in your yard. That is important. That's an important part of the spotted lanternfly control because that is their preferred host plant. Tree of heaven looks a lot like sumac. It's called Chinese sumac. It smells kind of like peanut butter or like burnt peanut butter. If you're not sure whether it's tree of heaven or not, there are many arborists that could kind of point you in the right direction. So that's one thing you could do. You could also look around for egg masses. And as I say, the egg masses look almost, to me, they always look like just kind of dried up gum. It looks like gray, like a grayish kind of scaly deposit that'll either be on, sometimes they're even on cars or on the sides of buildings of your resident or of your apartment building, and certainly on the barks of trees. So if you see those, you can scrape them off with a knife. You can scrape them off and try and destroy the egg masses. You can dispose of them, in two plastic bags inside of a plastic bag. And that will prevent, you know, new nymphs from being able to hatch from that egg mass the following spring. So those are some things that you can do. Definitely, if you're seeing them in Brooklyn, if you're seeing them in Prospect Park, you can report them, as I mentioned, Cornell, to Rutgers, to Penn State, to any of the extension agencies. You can also use iNaturalist. And iNaturalist is a citizen science app that you can get for your phone, and you can report where you're seeing a spotted lanternfly just by taking a photo. Sometimes they're hard to take a photo of because they're very, very quick to jump around. But if you're doing your mission, as you've been tasked to do, to try and squash one of these bugs, you can always snap a photo first for iNaturalist as well.
We all know people who we would describe as wouldn't hurt a fly and who might literally, with a fly in their home, try to sort of catch it in a jar and release it into the wild. Do we really have to kill them?
Well, that's a really good question, Brian, and it's a tough one. As an entomologist, I would say I know that this, you know, so these are bugs. They drink. They have sucking mouth parts, and they drink the xylem. They drink the sap from trees. And if you're just on a liquid diet, basically what comes out is basically liquid, and it's a sugary liquid. And that excretion, it's called honeydew. It actually can cover the trees and the leaves, and it allows this mold, this fungus, sooty mold, to grow, and that can actually damage the trees. So we expect the economic devastation for agriculture to be quite extreme. And so knowing that we live in a community where we want our fellow farmers and people who work in agriculture to be able to thrive, we want a world, we want a United States where they're not overrun with invasive species of insects, then yes. For those reasons, I would say it's not a bad idea to follow the directions of extension specialists and squash the insect. If you can't bring yourself to do it, even just observations, so that we can prevent the spread of these insects are important. You know, making observations, letting people know exactly where there's high densities of these insects are important, and also where there's high density of tree of heaven. And that's another good observation that you can make.
And as I understand it, one reason that we're being asked to squash these spotted lanternflies is to avoid having to use pesticides to handle the problem. There are studies that show, unlike the lanternflies, many insect species are in decline, and deforestation and pesticides are thought to be big causes of that. So can you talk a little bit about what may sound like a duality or a contradiction?
Yeah, I mean, whenever we talk about trying to save insects, people don't usually want to save things that are ugly, like maggots. And they really usually want to save things that are beautiful, like the spotted lanternfly. But in this case, it's kind of a 180 flip here. So this is a really beautiful insect. But if we don't do our job right now by squashing them, then the other options that we have available to us to prevent huge economic losses in agriculture would be to use broad spectrum insecticides. There are some specific insecticides also that do work for Hemiptera, which is the order to which these bugs belong. But we want to try and avoid that, because what we know from in terms of insect decline is that pesticide use from the general public as well as in agriculture seems to be one of the leading causes that we're seeing for this massive drop in number of species and abundance of species in habitats kind of globally. So we want to try and preserve insects, yes. But in this case, squashing this spotted lanternfly, this highly invasive insect, is going to help us prevent having to use insecticides that might have downstream negative effects that would kind of exacerbate an existing problem of insect decline. Of course, it's not just pesticides that are leading to insect decline. There are many other decisions that we could make in our day-to-day life that would kind of prevent or at least maybe hopefully lessen the mm-hmm. extreme acceleration of species loss that we're seeing. We could dim our lights. We don't have to have bright lights shining all night. There are many insects that are attracted to light that just basically exhaust themselves thinking it's the moon and kind of flying towards it, as well as it prevents, you know, bugs that actually, or insects that actually communicate with light, like beetles, like fireflies, from being able to find their mates. We could leave more open space. We could plant native plants. We could make a lot of decisions that would ultimately have really great impacts on insect populations.
I'm glad you mentioned so many of those things. Now, you're a credentialed bug expert. It looks like we have a licensed tree expert calling up. So we're going to match you two up. Sam in Short Hills, you're on WNYC. Hi, Sam.
Hi, Sam.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yep.
So I'm a licensed tree expert in the state of New Jersey. So I just figured I'd call in because I'm driving around my territory and I'm a little bit bored. And I figured I'd, I don't know, maybe add any insight that anyone wanted in terms of the locations and the life cycle of the insect or all of the above.
Well, maybe you could add your observations since this bug attacks trees. What are you seeing?
So I'm certainly seeing them go after Ailanthus trees, the tree of heaven. They're definitely attracted to that primarily. But on the whole, we're seeing them on pretty much all deciduous trees. More and more, I'm seeing them on walnuts, quite specifically. Mm-hmm. They seem to love that. They seem to love just fruit trees in general. They seem to be a huge fan of Japanese snowbell, as well as red maples, with the exception of black walnuts. With the exception of black walnuts, something that we're really finding on the whole is that they seem to be really attracted to trees with smooth bark as opposed to ridged and furrowed bark, which is pretty interesting. My guess is that it probably accommodates their proboscis, their mouthpiece, which is a lot like that of a mosquito actually plunging into the trunk. That would be my personal guess, but, you know, somebody else might have further insight.
Those are interesting observations. Do you think any of those patterns that you just described provide clues as to how to control this bug?
Not really. My personal feeling is that we're going to be living with this for a very long time. I think that, you know, certainly it might help to suppress some degree of the population by, you know, just sort of swatting at them or stomping on them. But I think that as time goes on, we're going to see higher and higher volumes of this insect. And something that, in my personal opinion and from what I've read, is probably an indicator that they're going to be around for a while, is it doesn't seem like they have a really significant capacity to actually kill trees, which in my mind is somewhat of an indicator that unlike a lot of invasive insects that do kill trees, they likely won't come to a point where they decimate their target host and then move on to a different, like, geographical part of the globe. I think they're just going to hang out for the foreseeable future.
I'm curious, and I'm sure a lot of our listeners are curious, considering how you started your call referring to yourself as a licensed tree expert. What kind of a license is that? And I'm sorry that it sounds like a boring job from what you said. But what is
it? No, it's actually, I like it. Maybe I pitched it as a boring job. So it's a license with the New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection with just regard to tree care.
Thank you very much for your contribution, Sam. Dr. Ware, a last thought?
Well, I definitely think Sam's observations kind of match what the entomological science says. We know that black walnut, red maple, river birch, willow, all, you know, grapes, apples, peaches, these are all really favored. Ailanthus, the tree of heaven, is their number one preferred host plant, but they're everywhere. And so I think this is a chance for us to kind of rally together as a community. We want to support our colleagues and friends and family in agriculture. We want to have delicious grapes and apples and peaches that we can consume. And so if we see these insects, if we see their eggs, we need to do something.
And there we leave it with entomologist Jessica Ware, associate curator in invertebrate zoology. Okay, zoology. At the American Museum of Natural History and Vice President of the Entomological Society of America, soon to be its president. Thank you so much. This was really informative. I could tell from our callers that they really appreciated you.
Thanks for having me. Wonderful to talk with you.
Thanks for listening to Brian Lehrer Weekend. We're back on the radio Monday morning at 10 a.m. In the meantime, follow us on Twitter at Brian Lehrer or Facebook.com/Brian Lehrer WNYC, where there's always a conversation 24/7.